This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Right, well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to our first winter and very wintry Landmark Women Speakers event. Thank you very much for coming out on such a cold morning. Before I welcome our wonderful speaker this morning, I have a few announcements to make. Now, firstly, to be aware that this event is recorded, so if you are meant to be somewhere else and you're trying to be anonymous, please don't speak. There will be questions and answers at the end, but we would ask that you wait for the microphone so that our speaker can hear your question and also so that we can capture that in the recording as well. I'd also like to do a few promotional bits. Just move to my props. Now, I know, who wouldn't want an excuse to put this on their head? We are having, you'll notice on your chairs, a promotional flyer for a spirited brunch. This year the museum is hosting Spirited, Australia's Horse Story, an exhibition talking about the history of the horse and its relationship with and role in building our country. So on Sunday, the 13th of July, we're having a fundraising brunch, a spirited brunch, which will involve best dressed, hat competitions and all sorts of lovely events. So please put that one in your diaries if you're available. We also have next month's speaker is Susie Beaver, so also put that date in your diaries as well. Susie is the owner of the very well-known Beaver Galleries here in Canberra. Now, on to today's event. I'm going to keep my hat on. I'm very, very pleased to welcome Dr. Julia Newton-Howes to today's speaker program. Dr. Newton-Howes has been CEO of Care Australia since 2007 and has spent the past 7 years ensuring that gender equality and women's empowerment are central to Care's programs. Julia is on the board of Care International and is Vice President of the Australian Council for International Development. Prior to joining Care Australia, she was Assistant Director General at AusAid, or the former AusAid. She held numerous positions within AusAid, including as Counsellor Development Cooperation in Vietnam, and was an advisor for 2 years to Australia's Executive Director to the World Bank, based in Washington, D.C. On Australia Day this year, she became a member of the Order of Australia in recognition of her significant service to aid organisations and particularly to women. Julia was born in India, spent her early life in Zimbabwe. She left Zimbabwe to attend the Imperial College in London at London University, where she obtained a bachelor degree and PhD in science. She has two untold beautiful children, a daughter and a son, and she's going to share her personal story with us today. Thank you, Julia.
Well, thanks very much, Monica, for that lovely introduction. And thank you all for coming along today. It's winter has really set in Canberra, and so I appreciate your willingness to come out on this freezing morning to hear a little bit about me. It's actually a great luxury to be asked to talk about your life, your work and your passions. And when I thought about it and I've thought about my life, I thought there were really three themes that perhaps trace the strands of the things that I've pursued during my life. So I hope those themes will come out during my talk. But let me tell you what they are. And it's nice to recognise a few faces in the audience, by the way. It's lovely to see some old friends here. Those themes are poverty, aid and development, gender equality and women's empowerment, and also, because I did train as a scientist, a fascination with numbers, with data, and wanting to see evidence and proof of things. So I hope I can draw those themes out in my talk. But first of all, let me introduce you to my parents, which I think, you know, is where everyone's life starts, isn't it? This is Joan and Rex Newton-Howes in 1950, and their beautiful dog, Rita. This was pre-children, And I'm not sure we ever really managed to replace Rita in their affections. But I think for so many of us, you know, our interest gender, the mic's, something's happened to the mic, hasn't it? The introduction to gender issues and gender stereotypes really comes through our parents, doesn't it? And it's something I became very conscious of because my mother, I mean, both my parents' lives were very affected by the Second World War. They both left school and immediately really joined up into the British Army. And my father fought with the Gurkhas and ended up in extraordinary places like Balochistan. And my mother, who left school with a bit of domestic science, was a cook, and she was a cook in various army messes. Couldn't wait to get out and see the world, so she ended up in Italy and then in Malaya, where she met my father in the Cameron Highlands. But my mother was a really practical person. She could do anything from making a wonderful dinner, to making all our clothes, to painting the house, to, you know, becoming an accountant, training herself in bookkeeping. And she really kept the family going. My father was a dreamer and a very clever man, but really quite impractical. And, you know, also left school with really no qualifications and then had this time in the army and did various things, became a salesman, and then opened his own photographic studio. But for my father, the grass was always greener on the other side of the hill, and which is really why I ended up being born in India. He was always saying to my mother, Joan, why don't we move to country X? Why don't we move to country Y? So my mother kept us grounded, kept everything going. And then when I grew up and read Betty Friedan and things like that, I thought back, I thought, you know, if my parents were my children's generation, it's pretty clear that my mother would have taken the role as the breadwinner. My mother would have been the one, you know, to really have a career. And my father perhaps would have been a lot happier looking after the kids and being much more of a homebody. So I suppose that was, you know, my early thinking on gender equality. But if I fast forward About 16 years, this is my mother with all her children in Zimbabwe. And it's a Christmas day, and that's my very long-legged sister and my brother who has got his first bicycle. And I'm standing there very proudly with a Barbie doll. And I don't know if you remember back to 1966, but those are Beetle boots I'm wearing. I was very, very keen on those Beetle boots, and I wore them really to shreds. So I grew up in Zimbabwe, and it was, you know, one of my father's wild flights of fancy that took the family off to India, where I happened to be born. But we came back fairly shortly afterwards. But I wanted to tell you a story about an incident that happened perhaps, it would have been about 18 months before this photograph was taken. So, you know, I came from a happy family where, you know, loving parents, and I think, you know, at this age I'd just started school. We just moved to Bulawayo, and so, you know, this was a new city, a new adventure, and I was, you know, the usual kind of excited and loving childhood. And for some reason, I wasn't at school that day, but my older brother and sister were both at school. And I was at home with my mother, and we were still unpacking from our big move. And I can remember helping my mother. And I met someone. Someone came to the door that day who really had a profound influence on my life. So there was this knock at the door, and I went with my mother to see who it was. And when she opened the door, there was a young woman there, a young African woman with a baby strapped to her back. And she looked at my mother with absolute desperation in her eyes. desperation. Desperation and I think fear. And she said to my mother, "I am so hungry. I have no food. I can't feed my baby. Please help me." And I watched as my mother went to the kitchen. She invited the young woman to sit down. She went to the kitchen. She cut some thick slabs of bread, put it with some cheese and meat, and made a cup of tea and gave it to the woman, who ate some and wrapped some up to take with her. And she left. But not something from that very brief encounter has really never left me. Why did I find it so confronting? Well, because as a child, I looked to my parents for everything, for love and care, for food and warmth, for safety and security. My parents were always in control. And I thought all adults were like that. And yet, here was a woman, an adult, a mother, who clearly wasn't in control. She couldn't feed herself or her baby. And I found that so confronting and shocking. And it left me with a lot of questions. What sort of world allowed this to happen? What had happened to this woman that had left her in these desperate circumstances? And why wasn't there someone else doing something about it? So I think that young woman who I met so briefly has really been something of a beacon throughout my life. And in some ways set me on a course, a journey that has resulted in me spending the last 2.5 decades of my life really working on poverty, issues of poverty and aid and development. And the path to how I got here certainly wasn't a straight one. But many times when I've had to make a decision, when I've thought about where I want to go and what's important to me, I've thought back to that young woman. And I can still see her in my mind's eye. And she's helped me to make some decisions. You know, another thing about growing up in Africa, we grew up very conscious of war and politics. We were all politicised from a very young age. We discussed the system of government we had and debated that. One of the things I also remember from my childhood was we used to pile into this old van that my parents had and drive down to Bara, which is this little town on the Mozambique coast, and we'd pitch a tent and have 2 glorious weeks running around in the sand. Now, there were probably a lot of Australian families the other side of the Indian Ocean doing pretty much the same. But there was a difference in Mozambique in that it was still governed by Portugal and there was a war of independence. So as we would get into the car, my parents would get us out of bed at sort of 4 a.m. and stick us in the back of this van and tell us to go back to sleep. And my father would give us this lecture about, now, if you hear shooting, you're not to look up. If there's explosions, if there's loud noises, don't look up. You stay lying on the back of the car. So as you can imagine, that became a bit of a dampener on the holiday. And but my parents loved Mozambique. The food, the Portuguese food that you could get there was extraordinary. And my father had this thing about piri-piri chicken. And my mother adored the Portuguese wines. And frankly, I can remember the cashew nuts you could buy in Portugal. They were just dusted with a bit of chili, and they were just fabulous. Now, you couldn't get anything like that at home. So we kept going on holidays. And then one year, there was part of the family ritual. You'd come across the border and then drive down this huge African escarpment and then across the flats to the coast. It was really spectacular. And somewhere along the way, just not so far across the border, there was a cafe where it was the ritual. We'd stop for breakfast and have our first taste of this delicious Portuguese food. But that year, we went in and sat down, and the same rather aging but very dignified waiter came to take our order, and we looked through the menu and chose our favourite dishes. And he, as we each ordered, he would say, "No, I'm sorry, we don't have that today." So my mother eventually said, "Well, what do you have?" And he said, "Well, I'm sorry, because of the fighting, we haven't had any resupplies here for a long time, but I think I can make you a cheese and tomato sandwich." So that was our last holiday in Beira, and I suspect that my parents thought it might be worth being shot at for piri piri chicken, but not for a cheese and tomato sandwich. The wars, there was this constant stream of refugees through Rhodesia, as it was then. I remember in 1974 when Portugal pulled out of Mozambique, and then I think it was 75 when they pulled out of Angola. And, of course, you know, wars of independence much earlier than that in places like Zambia and Nyasaland, which became Malawi. So there was this stream, you know, through my childhood, there would be these periods where you'd see refugees. Suddenly there were a whole lot of different people in the town looking confused, moving through. Some of them were anxious, some of them were, you know, desperately uprooted from the lives they'd had. So it did make me reflect on whether we'd be the next ones, really. And one of the things about those wars, and of course my adolescence was during a period of intensifying civil conflict in Zimbabwe, in Rhodesia as it was then, it made me work very hard at school, because I did see that having a decent education was a way to escape this situation, really an increasingly unbearable situation of civil war. So I was very fortunate to pass my A-levels and get accepted into London University, to Imperial College. And I set off with a backpack with my parents' good wishes and a couple of small scholarships to start life in London. And that was extraordinary. And I ended up doing a bachelor's degree, a PhD, and it was a lot of fun living in London. But I also recognised that I did not want to spend the rest of my life living in England. And Robert Mugabe came to power, and he took away the citizenship of all Zimbabweans who were not resident. So this was part of trying to control the diaspora. So I lost my Zimbabwean citizenship and looked around. And I think it's pretty much better than winning the lottery, really. I got a job in Australia and came here with a work permit and managed to get citizenship. And I think I've been incredibly fortunate to call Australia home for the last 30 years. It really is an extremely fortunate country to live in. So I came to Australia, and I worked at, first of all, at Monash University and the University of New South Wales, and in science and as postdoctoral research fellow, doing various different scientific things. But all the time I've been studying science, I still saw that young woman who came to our doorstep, and I still thought a lot about particularly African politics. But of course, when you come to Australia, you don't actually hear very much about Africa. You hear a lot about Asia. And so I started to learn more about this region and what was happening here. So I know while I was studying my PhD, and I probably should have been writing more papers, I was actually off at SOAS going to courses on African politics. So anyway, eventually I had a young baby, and my husband at the time had moved to Canberra for a job, and I was at the University of New South Wales with a young baby expecting my second. and decided that really it was time to move to Canberra. And I looked around at what job opportunities there were, and really the one place I wanted to work was AusAid. It was an opportunity to pursue this interest in aid and development. So I was extremely fortunate. I had actually helped set up one of the first cooperative research centres at the University of New South Wales with a really inspiring group of people. And I became its executive director. And then I think, as a lot of women do, I took a big step sideways and down in my career and joined the public service in a fairly, you know, in a fairly junior capacity. But I was pursuing something that I found deeply, deeply interesting. And I think when I reflect back on those 13 years in AusAid, where I met a couple of people here in the several people here in the audience, it was an extraordinary privilege to work in that organisation. I started out working in appraisals and evaluations. I worked on our program to Papua New Guinea, to Indonesia, to China. I was based in Vietnam for a couple of years. This was an opportunity to come to grips with the history, the culture of those countries, to try and understand poverty from the lens that it was seen within those societies. And it was, you know, an extraordinary and interesting place to work. And I also had this opportunity for a secondment to the World Bank. And then, you know, I'd been promoted a few times. I was actually managing a lot of AusAid's multilateral aid, Australia's multilateral aid, which, and particularly the relationships with the World Bank and the Asian Development Bank. So actually I had responsibilities across a huge portfolio of hundreds of millions of dollars, and it was terrific. And I got a call from a headhunter who said, oh, did I know that this job at CARE was coming up? And I said, oh, yeah, I had heard about it. And he said, well, had I thought about applying? And I said, look, I thought about it for about 30 seconds, but I'm really busy, so, you know, that was it. Anyway, he persuaded me to have a cup of coffee with him. And, you know, the one thing that is part of the context for aid and development is that a developed country has a capable government. It has a thriving private sector, and it has a vibrant civil society. And actually, you need all those things to come together for development. But my, you know, critique of a lot of government-to-government aid is that really it focuses almost solely on government, giving aid to government, through government, to try and create that capable government. And yet the need to balance that with a vibrant civil society has been too much, not ignored, but too much overlooked. It's been too much of a secondary priority. So when I thought about this opportunity to move to CARE, although CARE has a much smaller portfolio of activities, nevertheless, it was an opportunity to really engage in an area that I know is incredibly important for poverty and for effective development. So what I'd like to do next is introduce you to Lifanetti and tell you her story. And Lifanetti lives in Malawi, and she lives in a community that CARE's been working with for about a decade. And when we first started working in that area, it's an area that has a very high prevalence of extreme poverty. Lifanetti told one of our staff that when she went to the market with her husband, she would walk away from him. She'd leave him over there because they couldn't afford decent clothes, and all her husband had was a very ragged, torn shirt and a very old pair of trousers. And she was embarrassed for people to realise that her husband was so poor. And what CARE has done in this community, and we have done a range of things, but I want to particularly talk to you about the microcredit work. So when we come into a really poor community like that, we have had 20 years of experience at bringing groups of women together, maybe 12 or 15, and it's mostly women, although sometimes men also participate in these groups. They come together and they decide how much they can save together. And maybe it's just 20 cents a week. But when you put 20 cents, when you've got 15 women saving 20 cents a week, after a few weeks, there's enough there for them to start taking small loans. And Lifinetti took a loan for $5, and with it, she bought a metal tray and a 5-kilogram bag of flour. And she baked scones in an outdoor oven that her husband and she had built, with no need for expenditure. And she sold the scones in the market and managed to double the $5 to $10 so she could pay that back the next day with a small interest rate. And so these schemes, over the years, they gradually, with only the savings that those women have, they gradually change the women's circumstances. But when we do evaluations of this work, and we've done a lot of evaluations of this sort of work, the interesting thing is that the women tell us not just how important it's been to get access to these financial services, to be able to save, to be able to take a small loan, and there's usually a sort of social safety net associated with these, a little insurance scheme that's tied to these. But it's also when the women come together, they elect a chairperson, a treasurer, a secretary, and they all say, oh, I've never done anything like that before, I can't do it. But they come together and they encourage each other. And they do what women do everywhere. They sit down in their community and talk about their problems and issues and find ways to solve them. So when we evaluate these schemes, what the women tell us was the money has been very important because it has enabled us to dress better, to put a new roof on our house. My children now can afford the books for school. But it's actually the social capital that's been built up. Women tell us, I now have so much more confidence. I understand money. My husband respects me because I'm contributing to our family. And I now understand things better and I speak out at our village meetings. So it's actually the ability to work closely with these communities is incredibly important in bringing about social change. Poverty is never just a lack of money. It's also a lack of voice. It's a lack of connections within your society. It's a lack of confidence sometimes that comes so much from that, from your circumstances. Lifinetti's community lived in extreme poverty, and many of them have now moved beyond that. But when I say extreme poverty, I'm not sure what that means to you. Extreme poverty is currently defined as living on less than $1.25 a day. And people sometimes say to me, but actually life's quite cheap in developing countries, but it would be equivalent to trying to live on $1.25 a day here in Australia. And it really does mean that every day is a disaster and the simplest thing can push you over the edge. An illness in the family, well, you can't afford medicine. You can't get that book your child needs for school. If you break a cooking pot, you might have to go without a meal in order to replace it. To live in extreme poverty is really to live in circumstances that are unbearable. And when we think that we currently have a global economy that is worth about $70 trillion, it seems almost unbelievable that there still could be 1 billion people in the world today who live in extreme poverty. And 1 billion people sounds like a huge number. It is, and it's unforgivable. But actually, we've made huge progress in addressing extreme poverty. And this graph shows that In 1990, in developing countries, 43% of the population lived in extreme poverty. And now, well, in 2010, when this data shows, it had halved. It was 21%. So the world has made enormous strides in overcoming extreme poverty. But it's not enough. And we need to do more. The Brookings Institute did some calculations a few years ago to show that actually it would take $60 billion to create a social safety net that would bring everyone over $1.25 a day. $1.25 a day is still very poor, by the way, but it's just above that minimum level of that minimal level at which life is less desperate. $60 billion, actually the total aid that is given in the world each year is about $130 billion, so about half the total aid, if our aid was really focused on this area of extreme poverty. But the other thing about extreme poverty that is very striking is that actually the majority of people who live in extreme poverty are women. And unless we can address gender discrimination and the inequality that women face, we actually won't be able to overcome extreme poverty. And I think some of the statistics that are most striking for me is that, you know, 3/4 of the illiterate people in the world are women. Women in developing countries grow perhaps 50% of the food that's consumed, and yet they own probably only 1% of the farmland. And still, in many places, women are prevented from inheriting land. And when you go to a country where it's customary for women to be married off, perhaps at 16, to much older men, you might be a widow in your early 20s with young children, but not able to inherit anything from your husband. And it's these inequalities that have created and continue to create extreme poverty in the world. So one of the reasons I was so pleased to move to CARE is that CARE actually has done a huge amount of work in trying to understand gender inequality and women's empowerment, because in some ways these things are abstract concepts, and I know that for all of us our understanding of them is rooted in our own social and cultural context. And so it's interesting to try and analyse what it might mean, and can we paint a picture globally of what would it take to address these issues. And I'm going to run through this very quickly, but based on a huge amount of work across 44 countries around the world, we said we've actually got to work with women in 3 areas. And I will run through this because I think it's something that I want my daughter to understand. I think we all need to understand this. You know, a lot of aid works here on women's agency. So this is women's individual skills. Let's give this woman training, access to some credit. That's enough. She'll then be empowered and able to go her way. But actually it isn't enough, because women, even if you get the girl to school, if her father or her husband won't let her leave the house or start a business, she's still not necessarily able to make what she wants out of her life. So we actually also need to affect the relationships through which women negotiate their lives, and that's relationships with siblings, with parents, with husbands, and with those within the community that set the expectations that women live with. And then, of course, if you can address those two, but you still face cultural or social or legal barriers. No, women can't inherit from their husbands. Then, you know, you still haven't created the full picture. And so what we seek to do through our programs is work through all 3 of those domains of women's lives. And when you can bring about change in all 3 of those domains, you do see change. And that probably still sounds a little bit abstract. So we've done some work to say, okay, but how do you know if you've brought about sufficient positive change? And we've tried in quite simple terms to say, okay, well, this is what actually an empowered woman looks like. It's a woman who can control productive assets, who participates in her community. She makes important household decisions. She makes decisions about her body and her own sexual and reproductive health, and she can live a life free from violence. So then I think this work is very important in trying to translate some quite potentially theoretical concepts into really practical sets of issues. But more important than that, these are issues that we discuss, our staff discuss within their communities in appropriate ways, and the communities themselves can take on these issues and seek to bring about change. Now, I'm conscious of the time. I would like to very briefly talk about humanitarian emergencies. CARE does a lot of responding to humanitarian emergencies, and it's been a very bad year for emergencies. Typhoon Haiyan, of course, we're entering the fourth year of the Syrian crisis, and South Sudan. We're seeing massive displacements of people, and these are terrible events that really push people back into poverty. There's also many ways in which women and men face these emergencies very differently. But when I look at the time, I think I'm going to skip over that slide and give you one last story about my mother, because she really had a huge influence on my life. And this is her and me when I was very, very young. And I've always had a problem with neat hair. So it started at an early age. I think I mentioned before that my mother was fed up with staying at home and looking after children. And once she'd got us off to school, she trained herself in bookkeeping and went and got a job, actually very much against my father's wishes. So that was an interesting negotiation. And she got a job with a government-owned bank at a fairly junior level, but she was very clever and very capable. So, you know, she kept doing more and more things. But she was a woman, so she couldn't be promoted. And what she ended up doing was they got her to train all the men who came into the bank, and all the men would be promoted, and she wouldn't be. But there were some senior men who were quite sympathetic to her situation, and one day one of them took her aside and said, look, this management position's coming up, and you're clearly, you know, you'd do a very good job in it. Why don't you apply? And I think that was a hard decision for my mother, but she did apply. You know, you put yourself on the line when you go out and do something like that. But she did apply, and all the men got together in horror at the idea of letting a woman into management, and she was blocked. And someone she'd trained got the job. Anyway, she didn't tell me about that at the time, but she told me about it many years later, and she was still absolutely furious. So when I look back at my life, I know I have been incredibly lucky to have so many opportunities, but we still do live in a world that can offer us everything or nothing. And poverty is not actually something that is about our own talents, our own abilities. It's very much a lottery of birth. And I think it's not really tolerable to live in a world that still lets this happen, that still lets a billion people live in such degrading circumstances. So I hope you'll agree with me. Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk.
That was wonderful. Thank you, Julia. Now, we do have some time for questions and answers. Just raise your hand and I'll bring the mic to you.
I'm interested in the fact that in many countries that you've served, the inheritance does not go to the wife. Does that mean that she's got to provide for herself and all her children and none of the inheritance goes to them, even if they're boys in a society that values men first? And the other thing is, who does it go to?
Well, that's a really interesting question. There isn't a single answer because it is very cultural specific. But certainly this is a massive issue in parts of Africa and particularly the Sahel and West Africa. So we'll go to the man's brothers and back to the man's family, so usually his brothers, any land, any assets. And yes, often the woman is thrown out with nothing but her children. And that's clearly an issue that causes poverty. In some places, the children have to stay with the family and she's thrown out. Now, these are things that, you know, will occur differently in different places and it's not a universal, but still we can see in our programs across Africa that that is a major cause of poverty. Female-headed households, it's a big factor in poverty and it's the lack of legal support for women's inheritance that is at the heart of their inability to fight for any rights around that.
You mentioned that you had worked in areas in Asia like Vietnam and so on. I gather you've seen firsthand some of the traumas of poverty. How do you personally handle that? It must be a huge feeling of almost anger at times. How do you manage that?
Yes, you know, it can be, particularly when you go somewhere after a major emergency, it can be very confronting and very depressing. But I suppose the way I handle it is that I have a very strong conviction that this is a problem we can solve. And so it's about, this is about doing more to overcome that issue. So, you know, and I'm usually going into communities where we've got things going and it's about, you know, assessing how do we do more? How can we change this? And particularly extreme poverty is very solvable. So I think it has to reaffirm your commitment to tackle this issue. I think there are many issues around the politics that mean that, you know, some issues are beyond us to solve, but by working with people to give them a voice, to support them to a point where you can dream about a future, then it's up to them to choose their government and create the society in which they live. But to overcome extreme poverty is something we can do, and I think it deserves more focus.
One of the other Millennium Development Goals, I believe, was targeted at education, and particularly education of girls. Can you tell us how that's been going, and what are organizations like CARE and AusAid and other development organizations doing in that area?
Well, the Foreign Minister has just made an announcement today of, I think it's $140 million to a big education initiative. Actually, the Millennium Development Goal has had a big impact in the area of primary education, and we have seen primary education really increase significantly, and also in many countries we've got close to parity between girls and boys in primary education. I think it's a success story. But we are still seeing that transition rates to middle school or senior school for girls are much lower than boys, and girls tend to start dropping out very quickly. The other thing about it is that actually getting girls into school or boys is not enough. We have to concern ourselves with quality of education. But in the case of girls in particular, it's incredibly important to teach girls leadership and actually address some of those issues around the societal expectations of girls. There's an interesting study in Latin America which shows that even when girls, in some place, poor places, when girls are graduating from senior school, they're actually not getting jobs. There's still very high teen pregnancy rates because we haven't addressed those issues of girls' self-confidence, the society's expectations of girls. Those things really still constrain girls. Girls, what the sorts of opportunities that they see, the sorts of futures that they can imagine for themselves. We've done some work in Timor-Leste where we produced material on successful women in Timor-Leste. And, of course, there's some amazing women in government in Timor-Leste and some very well-known international figures. But actually, we chose to profile the woman who ran the shop or, you know, people close to home to give girls an idea of you know, people close to them and opportunities that they could aspire to. And we often in schools would go in and run activities, specific activities for girls because, you know, if you live in a society where girls are expected to play a secondary role to men, then you'll see in the playground or when clubs are set up that boys, you know, boys take all the leadership roles. So, we, it is important not just to get girls into school but also address, ensure that they have the voice and the opportunity within that to dream a little bit more.
Julia, it's a lovely talk. Thank you. Very, very interesting. I had a question when you talked about sustainable empowerment, which is a wonderful concept universally. How registered and government aid organisations such as CARE and Salvation Army and whoever, how you feel about philanthropists such as Bill Gates or whoever you want to pick, putting bulk amount of money into those systems, does it undermine the systems that you're trying to put in place, or does it work against you? Just wondering if you can talk about that.
No, I think philanthropists like Bill Gates are doing some truly amazing stuff. I mean, he has had a particular focus on health. He funds a really broad range of things. There's many, many ways in which you can work on development, and as responsible companies, through ensuring your business operations in developing countries are ethical, through new initiatives to promote, anti-malarial campaigns. There are many, many things you can do. But what I want to see, and I support all of them, but not enough focus is going on very poor communities and extreme poverty. And I suppose that's the theme that I want to see. And these are solutions that perhaps with very good governments, and different policies would be overcome. But I don't believe those good governments will come unless we've really addressed the issues that hold whole communities back because, of the extreme circumstances they live in. So let's create empowered women, empowered communities. I mean, the other thing which I should have said and didn't say, we focus on women also because, we did some, it's not terribly rigorous research, but we do know that women put most of their resources, when they have access and control over assets, they put most of their assets back into their family and immediate community, whereas men are much less inclined to do that. So if the intergenerational benefits from women having access to resources are huge, it has a huge impact on child nutrition, the extent to which children go to school and so forth. So I've strayed a bit from your question, but, much more energy deserves to be going into community development, creating empowered women and empowered communities. But there's plenty of difficult development challenges to get people engaged, and I think it's wonderful when people do, think beyond their shores. A question I'm often asked is, but there's poor people in Australia, why should we look overseas? But, we live in a really globalised world, and what happens in Papua New Guinea does affect us, and as a very wealthy country, we should be doing both. So I think I think for people who are struggling with some of these difficult issues, it's terrific.
Coming from that, you talk quite a lot about the lady as the breadwinner, and yet there's frequently a husband in the background, for example, the scone lady. Now, to what extent are the husbands dragging them down?
Well, thank you for that terrific question, because one of the things we seek to address, I mean, we're not going into these communities wanting to start gender wars. And most people want to have a good relationship with their spouse. So it is about working with men and women on community attitudes to women. And so without going into a whole lot of technical detail, it's about setting up dialogue within the community. We've found in some of our work on education in Cambodia, where girls weren't going to school, that actually working with men and boys to has been critical to getting girls into school. So the last report I read on that work, we'd done a survey of men's attitudes to the changes and women's attitudes to the changes. And men have embraced it. I mean, there's comments, things like, well, I used to have to make all the decisions in my household. I'm very happy now that my wife is bringing in some resources and we make decisions jointly, because, you know, some of the decisions we make are really difficult. So, what we're trying to do is to create gender equality. That community in Malawi, which I've had such fortune to visit twice, you know, I've never seen a TV there. There are a few mobile phones. But people, there's still such an oral tradition. So the first time I was there, they put on a play for me, and I will never forget it, in this very crowded little school hall. And the play was all about this drunken man, and there was a lot of alcohol problems, and how he was drunk. He was a drunkard, and he was letting down his wife and family. And now, with his wife, you know, joined the savings and loan scheme and made this money, and it woke him up out of his bad ways. And now he's a reformed character. So, we work with women's empowerment as a way to change whole communities, and we find it very successful.
Look, thank you so much, Julia. That was an absolutely wonderful and inspiring presentation. Look, please join me once again in thanking Julia for spending some time with us today.
Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.